That's the big question. And the answer to that is to figure out who you need to be talking to and what issues you need to be thinking about. You need to hit the ground running with this in most instances. Usually in the aviation world, the primary government agencies that you'll be dealing with operational issues are the NTSB, FAA, and or DOT. And in dealing with those agencies, you need to be thinking about not only how you deal with them, but also insurance issues, civil liability, and criminal liability. I'll start off with the NTSB here and take you through some of the processes in dealing with them, processes in dealing with the FAA, and then I'll turn it over to Kent, and he can talk to you about DOT and some of these other issues that you should be thinking about. In having an aircraft accident or incident, there's kind of a gateway question to answer before you need to decide if you are actually even talking to the NTSB about the particular issue. And that question is, was it an accident or incident? And there's kind of a caveat to that of a reportable incident as well that I'll get into a little bit later. Accidents are huge. They stay on the pilot's record for pretty much their life. If it is a company that has a certificate, like a Part 135 company, that accident will also stay with the Part 135 company, and it has serious implications for you and, of course, in insurance and other types of liability as well. The NTSB has a particular definition for what an accident is, and that is, first, the aircraft has to be moving with the intention of flight, and it has to, the particular incident has to have one of these three components. Either there was a death involved, there's serious injury, or substantial damage. In figuring out if there was intention for flight, it's pretty clear, you know, in most of your minds, if you're taxiing out to the runway for takeoff with passengers in the back, you have the intent to fly. But there are often times that you're operating the aircraft around the airport where that may not be true. Taxing the aircraft over to move it from hangar to hangar, moving it over for maintenance run-ups, those kinds of incidents, even though you're operating the aircraft on the airport, it's not for the intention of flight. And so if you run into a tug or, you know, hit the winglet on the side of a building, that kind of incident is not going to be classified as an NTSB accident. Kind of one of the other interesting things in moving on to whether or not you've had a death associated with the operation of the aircraft, it's associated with the operation of the aircraft. That's the important phrase to remember. If you have some kind of an issue in flight and, you know, say there's a medical issue with a passenger in back, a heart attack, even though that happened in flight and, you know, was a part of the operation of the aircraft in terms of it, the aircraft being in flight, that is not related to the actual operation of the aircraft in the eyes of the NTSB and doesn't count as a death for the purposes of determining whether or not it's an accident. Now, if you have a heart attack in front or some other medical issue with a crew member, that may not be an accident, but it might be a reportable incident. The other thing that can bring you under the definition of being an accident is serious injury. There's a whole list of things here. Most of them are way above my head. I'm not, you know, a doctor, so I can't tell you what all of these things are. Basically, the kind of rule of thumb to remember is if somebody is going to the hospital, you probably have an accident. And what I would suggest to all of you is first have an emergency response plan for your corporate flight department and go ahead and list these things in your response plan so that whoever's back at base that's going to be looking at, you know, what happened and what are our first steps, they've got it right there in front of them. They're not struggling to go find NTSB Part 830 to look up all of these definitions. Substantial damage. If you read through this definition, it could pretty much affect everything, especially with turbine-powered aircraft. I mean, anything other than really a paint scuff falls under this. So this definition itself, you know, everything that would require replacement of the component or affected part, that's huge. That pretty much involves everything. The most important part about substantial damage is, are the exceptions. This is where you have some room to talk about what's actually happened with the aircraft, what damage was sustained, and whether or not that rises to the level of having an accident. The first one, engine failure or damage limited to an engine, if only one engine fails, that, you know, happens a bit more routinely, but there's one thing to remember on this that I'll touch on later. This is really meant more for piston engines, and there is a type of a reportable incident that is for turbine engine failure. So you might not fall into the accident category, but you may still have a reportable incident if you have an issue with the engine. The next exception is what we call the tail dragger ground loop exception. If you think about a tail dragger taxiing out, you know, in high winds and they end up doing a ground loop, what types of damage that tail dragger might sustain, those things are not covered under accidents. The reason for that is the NTSB just got tired of hearing about all of these guys with all of their cubs out there ground looping it on the runway, you know, messing up some of the fabric and wingtips, and just didn't want to have all of those reported. The interesting thing about this particular exception with respect to turbine aircraft, though, is the very last word, wingtips. In our world, we don't have wingtips all the time. At times, we'll have winglets on our aircraft. And there are differing opinions between different NTSB inspectors and sort of the association as a whole as to whether or not a winglet qualifies as a wingtip or as a part of the wing. And that's a huge distinction. If it's a wingtip, then maybe if you ding the wing or the winglet into the side of the hangar, that might not be a reportable accident. If it's a part of the wing surface, that would be a reportable accident. So you have to be careful in kind of understanding what the damage is and speaking with your mechanics and your other advisors as to determine, you know, what the extent of the damage was and what possibility there may be of whether or not you need to report that to the NTSB and what other administrations might be coming in to take a look at what you've done. If you've determined that you've had an accident, which is reportable to the NTSB, you've got to report this immediately. The word immediately is what they use in the regulation. There's no period of time, like 24-hour window, week-long period of time. It's pretty much immediately with some reasonable judgment put in there. You can find the contact information for the NTSB at ntsb.gov, and that I would also suggest would be something to put in your emergency response plan so it's there for you should you need it. You don't have to go looking around for that. And you have to remember, too, as I discussed a little bit before, in addition to these accidents, you also have specific incidents that might be reportable. And you also have to remember that if you have overdue or believed to be accident aircraft, those are also something that might need to be reported to the NTSB. The types of incidents that typically have to be reported deal more with specific failures of systems in flight. This is a list of some of them, you know, flight control system malfunction or failure, illness or medical issue with a crew member in flight that might affect their ability to perform their duties, failure of structural components with turbine engines. This is where that piece draws you back into a reportable incident, even though an engine issue might not be an accident per se. In-flight fires and mid-air collisions are also on that list. Once again, put these in your emergency response plan, have them there, have somebody who is the primary contact on the emergency response plan trained in sort of understanding what these mean and what type of actual incidents might fall into these categories. Some of the other more interesting, or I guess not as obvious, incidents that might be reportable to the NTSB are involve damage to property on the ground. If you damage a hangar, if you damage other aircraft, if you damage things other than the particular aircraft that you're operating, and that damage is in excess of $25,000, that incident might be reportable to the NTSB. And this is an interesting and different one as well, because most often it takes a little while to determine the extent of the damage of what's happened, both with the aircraft and other property that might be involved, which makes it a little bit difficult in trying to determine, you know, when do you do the notification for the NTSB, because it's supposed to be immediate, but you might have a close line call as to whether or not you fall above $25,000 or below. It's pretty clear that if you know the damage is going to be excessive, if you're talking about a turbine aircraft and you're talking about maybe running into another turbine aircraft or running into a high value piece of equipment, you're probably going to fall over that line. And you don't want to get into the issue of, well, it took me, you know, a week and a half to figure out what the repair bill was, and so I couldn't report it to you for a week and a half. If the repair bill ends up being, you know, in the order of $1 million or $2 million, the NTSB is not really going to look at that too kindly. One of the other ones that kind of falls into in-flight issues are in-flight issues of electrical systems that require you to that require sustained use, and that's an important term, of backup power or backup systems. In the age of having glass cockpits and Windows processors in our little screens up front, there are often times where those screens, you know, do the blue screen of death and you're restarting and rebooting and running off emergency power until you get that back up. The important thing to remember about this is sustained use. If you've got an in-flight fault and you can reset the circuit breaker, reboot the system, whatever it is that your particular process is, and you get it back up and running, it probably doesn't rise to the level of being a required incident to report to the NTSB. Another big one too, pretty much anything with flight control surfaces. If you have an issue with your flight control surfaces or hydraulic systems or systems that, you know, are required for actually maintaining the aircraft straight and level in flight, it's probably going to be something that's reportable to the NTSB. So you might want to phrase it that way and putting it in your emergency response plan of, you know, simple terms. Was it an issue with the flight control? If yes, then somebody else with more technical experience needs to take a look at what it is and make a determination of whether or not notification of the NTSB is required. Some other ones, sustained loss of power or thrust with two or more engines. Now, this isn't an engine out per se. This could be just loss of power due to, you know, any number of factors. But it is for two engines. So if you're running on reduced power on one engine, not both, might not be an incident that's reportable. And of course, evacuation of an aircraft when you're using an emergency egress system. So, moving on. Once you get past the determination of whether or not you have to talk to the NTSB, and just kind of in general issues, if it doesn't involve an accident or incident, one of the biggest areas of concern that you should be thinking about in all of your operational issues is FAA enforcement. And it's important to understand your appeal rights. If you understand what the FAA has in terms of rights to present against you and what you have in terms of rights to defend yourself and appeal the FAA's decision, it makes a difference in understanding how you should approach the FAA from the beginning, especially through the investigation process, because that's when all of the facts, all of the information, and all of the evidence are being gathered. So if you understand the process of how that will be applied in the future, it can help you determine how to better work with the FAA up front to have a better outcome. Basically, your appeal rights start with your informal conference. You move through to a hearing with an administrative law judge. After that, you've got an appeal to the full board of the NTSB. And finally, pretty much your last stop is the Circuit Court of Appeals. There is one higher stop on this that we never put on the slide because as yet it hasn't happened yet, and that's of course the Supreme Court of the United States, but it is in the appeal path. It's just no aviation case has ever made it that far. And then of course once we get through the appeals process, you can kind of start back and think about how to deal with ramp checks and to deal with the letter of investigation and other investigative processes that the FAA uses. The informal conference. If the FAA has decided to take enforcement action against you, you'll be notified of this with a notice of proposed certificate action. This is after all of the investigation has taken place, they've actually decided to move forward. The notice of proposed certificate action is going to tell you what the FAA thinks that you've done wrong and what the potential sanction is. At that point, you have the option to accept that potential sanction, move forward, and the process is done. Or you can appeal that notice of proposed certificate action, and you appeal it to an informal conference. An informal conference is your opportunity to sit down with the FAA attorney that's in charge of prosecuting your particular issue, and hopefully the investigator that actually prepared the file against you. Now, it doesn't always happen that you get to sit down with that particular inspector, but you will have an attorney and an inspector. And this is really an important step in the process. As you'll kind of see when we go through all of these appeal rights, the ones that are at the very beginning are the most important. That's the opportunity for you to speak with the FAA with a bit more candor, to talk about what the issues are, and potentially come to a settlement. The farther along you get down the process, the more formal it is and the less opportunity you have to come to some kind of an understanding. Before you go into the informal conference, it's important to use one of your rights that you have under the Freedom of Information Act to obtain a copy of your enforcement investigative report. This is the report that was prepared by the inspector and provided to the FAA attorney. It has all of the information and evidence that the FAA has gathered against you and lays out, you know, it doesn't lay out their strategy per se in court, but gives you everything that they have. It's very important to have that going into the informal conference because it can allow you to figure out what your strategy is. It lets you know what the FAA knows and what maybe they don't know. If you're not able to come to a settlement in the informal conference and the FAA is intent upon moving forward with your notice of proposed certificate action, they'll actually send you, you'll know what your certificate action is and you can appeal that up to an administrative law judge hearing. This is your one and only opportunity to go into court. And this is the only time that it's actually going to kind of look like court, although it won't be much like civil or criminal court. The ALJ hearing is in front of one of four administrative law judges in the United States. They travel to you and there's no jury. It's basically you, the FAA, whatever witnesses the two parties might have, and the judge. And the interesting thing about this is it's very much different from any criminal or civil trials. The rules of evidence, calling of witnesses, all of those kinds of things, the evidentiary rules, they're only advisory in these hearings. The FAA can put on, as a part of its case in chief, hearsay evidence. They can go get the tug driver who is out on the ramp, who talked to the FAA inspector, and have him testify that he heard some other pilot hear you say that you did something 3 weeks ago. That's acceptable. Now, that would never fly in regular court, but in this kind of hearing, that gets on, that gets into evidence. So it's important to understand that and important to know that when you go into a hearing like this, you've got to have somebody with you that can represent you that understands that fact. That's key to coming out through this hearing. After you've presented your case and the FAA has presented their case, the judge is going to rule on what the facts of the particular case are. This is the time at which those facts are established. Anything after this in the process, you're appealing pretty much how the law was applied to the facts or really arbitrary and capricious rulings of the judge. That's it. This is the key time to have your witnesses and your evidence in order and to present the best case that you can. If you get through the ALJ hearing and there's a sanction that you're not happy with, or the FAA gets through and there's a sanction or lack of a sanction and they're not happy with it, then either party can appeal the decision up to the full NTSB board. At this level, there's no hearing, no oral argument, nothing. You don't even get to go see the NTSB. All of the information is provided to them by paper. They read over it all. They make a determination and send it back to you. That's it. So your opportunity to get in front of them and convince them of your position is kind of through at that point. The board is supposed to respect the credibility findings of the ALJ, because that's a factual determination. And so that's the supposed to is kind of key there. There are times when the board has looked back at it and gone against what the ALJ has said. But in general terms, what the ALJ comes to a decision on facts and credibility pretty much stands. These are the only decisions, the board-level decisions, that are precedent. They're also the only decisions that are published. They come out and they're freely accessed or can be freely accessed on the NTSB's website through Westlaw and other types of services. So once you get up to this level, your name's going to be out there as having been involved in enforcement action. If you're unhappy with the outcome at the NTSB board level, you can appeal it up to the Circuit Court of Appeals. At this point, and up to this point, I probably should have hit this earlier, up to this point, your appeals stay the effect of the order. That means that you, in most cases, unless it's an emergency or some other type of issue, you can continue to exercise the privileges of your certificate, which is great, especially for pilots. That's their livelihood. Being able to continue to fly is huge. Once you get up to the Circuit Court of Appeals, it's only a may. There's times at which it might and times at which it won't. And if you've got an emergency situation of any kind, for the most part, your appeal, whatever it is not going to stay the effectiveness of the order unless you win on the emergency issue, which comes very, very early in the process. The thing to remember with an appeal to the Circuit Court of Appeals is that these aviation cases are basically the lowest priority on the docket. They're not going to pop up early. They're going to get docketed years in out. You may have had an incident that happened, in 2000, and you might not hear back from the circuit court for, 3, 4, 5 years. And all that time, you're flying around, hopefully exercising the privileges of your certificate because the order has been stayed, but you still kind of have that cloud hanging over you. It's one of the hugest issues for pilots and other certificate holders that talk to us is, getting some kind of resolution, either good or bad, quickly is really not possible in the FAA enforcement scenario. You kind of have to play the wait and see game. And unfortunately, a lot of the times, if you try to urge the FAA to move forward or, make any kind of I guess, move in that direction, you might end up doing yourself more harm than good. So there's often times when the FAA does investigations, gets through the informal conference, and maybe even through the ALJ hearing, and you don't hear anything from them. You're kind of done with everything, and it's kind of just out there hanging in the bounds, and you don't know what's going on. But it's important to remember that there's just not a lot that you can do at that point, and it's better not to rattle the cage than to try to get things moving forward quickly. At this point in the Court of Appeals, their standard truly is arbitrary and capricious. If you get up to this point and you're not happy with the decision, especially if it was in a decision by the ALJ that was upheld by the board, your chances of success at this level are pretty slim. So just remember, whatever you can do earlier in the process, the better you'll be. So now that you kind of understand the appeal rights for these enforcement actions, they give you some background on what you should be thinking about during FAA investigations. You need to keep some things in mind. First, the FAA can present whatever evidence they want at trial. So you need to be thinking about that when you're talking to them right after an incident. And second, you have to remember that your opportunities for speaking reasonably with the FAA are very limited. And they come very early in the process. If you put forth a bad foot in the investigative process and you've got egos rubbing together or something else going on with a particular FAA investigator, your ability to speak reasonably with them in the next 6-month period, which is when you're going to be doing your informal conference, and maybe in the next year or so period when you'd be doing your ALJ hearing, is going to decrease significantly. You've got to remember to try to be as nice as possible in all of this. But you do have to remember your rights, or lack thereof. When you're speaking with an FAA investigator, you're never going to get a Miranda warning. They're never going to tell you that you have the right to remain silent, that you have the right to counsel, any of that. They're going to talk to you. They're going to talk to you like some, a fellow pilot that's out at the airport, fellow mechanic that's out there, interested party that just heard something about it. They might not even identify themselves as a member of the FAA. They might just come up to you and strike up a conversation. You have to be wary of that. If something's happened, you need to be thinking about, first, what do I need to do to make sure that I'm not, just giving out all of the information to anybody that's standing around me, which I know for a lot of pilots, I'm a pilot too. That's kind of the first thing, our first reaction to something going wrong. I want to troubleshoot it. I want to figure out what happened. Try and avoid that response, if at all possible. If you have to leave the airport to avoid that response, leave the airport. And that's the other thing to remember. The FAA can't legally detain you there. You can let them know, oh my gosh, my wife just had a car accident. I've got to go to the hospital to go meet her. Whether or not she had a car accident, the FAA is probably not going to know about or be able to find out about, but just get out of the airport, get away from them. Have the time to get yourself calm and collected and start figuring things out before you talk to them. And also remember, too, after the incident and after the investigation, there might be the FAA has 6 months to give you a notice of proposed certificate action. So there's going to be a couple or a little bit of lapse in time there before you hear back from them. And even if you've gone past the 6-month period, there are some exceptions that allow the FAA to bring that enforcement action even post 6 months. So even though you haven't heard from them in maybe a year or a year and a half, it might not have completely gone away. And so you should just kind of, you know, make sure that that's still in your mind so you don't get surprised by it later on. Once they've gone through the investigation, typically your enforcement action will start out with a letter of investigation. And I say typically because up until Teterboro accident, February 2005, that was how things were handled. You got a letter of investigation when something happened, and you worked with the inspector at that point. They processed the file, and you went on down the path. In the brave new world of operational control issues and other types of issues that are of more immediate concern to the FAA, you might skip right past this. You might be under investigation. They might never send you a letter, and there's really not a lot that you can do about that. So just be wary that the primary indicator of the letter of investigation might not be there, but you might still be under investigation. If you do receive the letter of investigation, it's going to come, they've got a pretty much a form letter, and at the end or somewhere in the letter, it always says, respond within 10 days or the file will be processed without the benefits of your comments. I've answered probably 100 calls from pilots and mechanics going, oh my gosh, you've got to look at this right now. I got it 3 days ago. We've got to draft this response. It's going to have to be this huge memorandum of facts and everything else. You don't have to respond to this letter. There's no requirement to respond. And in fact, what you should be doing is thinking about what all of the facts and everything that's related to this particular incident are and writing them down. Now, not that you would be submitting that to the FAA, but just to keep it in your own mind and keep it fresh. How to respond to this letter, 99% of the time, is to write a letter back within the time period allotted that says, thank you for the opportunity to respond. That's, in the most cases, that's what you need to do. Be courteous and be kind to the FAA. Thank them for the opportunity to respond, but there's no need to give them any substantive information. And it's really not the time to grovel at that. If there is an opportunity to grovel, it will come later, and your attorney will tell you about that, I'm sure. Another thing to remember just on the substantive information, if at all possible, don't submit it at this point unless you're absolutely positive. And really, even then, I worry. It's kind of early in the process to be handing over all of your cards. The informal conference is really the time to go over those kinds of that kind of information with the FAA. The important thing to remember in all FAA investigations and pretty much all government investigations, don't lie. Mom and Dad, I'm sure, beat that into you when you were a kid. It's true. Don't lie here. It won't help you. They will be able to figure it out, and it will have much worse consequences than the actual enforcement action would have had prior to you lying. I mean, the important thing to remember, and the reason why we have Martha's lovely picture here is, I'm sure you all remember why she went to jail. It wasn't for any of the things that anybody was investigating her for. It was for lying. If you don't want to give them the truth, then say nothing at that point. That's a much better option than lying. And I'm going to turn it over to Kent to talk to you about some of the particular instances.
Thanks, Lori. This is a tough subject right here. What do you do when a controller says, say altitude? And Lori and I have been giving these talks to pilots and other groups for years, and this slide comes to me from FAA controllers. In fact, the next two slides are from discussions I've had with ATC. Don't ever lie, okay? Don't say you're at an altitude, you're not. But if you're a nanosecond from being where you're supposed to be, get there and report where you're supposed to be. I'm told by controllers they'd rather you did it. Now, if it's traffic 12 o'clock, 1 mile, say altitude, there's no time. You need to say where the heck you are. But, again, this is a sensitive subject. I'm relaying to you what I've been told by ATC, not necessarily endorsing it. This is another tough subject. Something happens and ATC says, after you land, call this phone number. Are you required to respond? It's kind of a trick question. You're required to say, Roger. Are you required to call? No. Absolutely not. Standard lawyer advice is, of course you don't make that call, because they're going to record it and they're going to get a confession out of you. All sorts of bad things will happen. Here's the problem. You know, I've been a pilot for 30 years now. Sometimes the call works. Sometimes the call heads off a misunderstanding and nips something in the bud. One of the things to understand about the FAA is that, you know, there's not one government, there's not one FAA. And typically ATC people consider themselves separate and in some ways above the people who investigate these matters at the FISDO level. And if you take the chance and make the call, and it was a minor thing, and ATC, the manager of the unit wants to know that you understood what happened, and maybe they want to understand that something happened, you might be able to work things out, and that's the end of it. What you need to be aware of is the situations where it's a him or you situation. If a controller is in a situation where the controller is going to get suspended if you were not at fault, and typically we're talking about a altitude conflict, then it's tougher to make that call, because the person on the other end is more likely to try and twist your words for the tape. Remember that you're being recorded. So, I don't say never make the call. I say stop and think, use some judgment about that call. And the other tough thing about this call is you've got to do it fairly quickly. You've got to do it after you land. Piece of advice from the real world, wait until you land. We had a case a few years ago where the captain picked up the flight phone and started yelling at the manager of the ATC unit while the flight was still in progress. That was a bad move. All right. NASA form. And, you know, everything we're talking about, we keep using pilot examples, but this applies to mechanics too. And mechanics have a specific NASA form. A lot of mechanics don't realize that, but there's a pilot form, there's a mechanic form, there's a controller form. All available on the NASA website that you see right there. Things to remember, what is the NASA form? The NASA form is a program that the FAA started to collect information about what's going on in the system, specifically what's going wrong. And the FAA knew that pilots, mechanics, and controllers would be nervous about telling the FAA of problems that they see. So they created a program that's conducted by NASA where you submit the information to NASA. You still do it on paper. I'm sure that this will be done on the web sooner or later. But at this point, you can type it on your computer from their website and print it out, but you have to mail it. By mailing that within 10 days, if the FAA later comes after you, you can show a little identification strip that comes back to you from NASA to prove that you participated in this program, and this doesn't relieve you of the violation, but it relieves you of the suspension. So if you had an altitude deviation, you filed a NASA form, you got the identification strip back, FAA comes after you for the deviation, wants to suspend your certificate for 30 days. Because of this program, you wouldn't have to turn in your certificate. You'd keep flying. Your record would show that you had the violation, just as if you'd served the suspension. But still a useful program. You can't use a NASA form if you did something intentionally. Okay? If you went and buzzed the nude beach and you got somebody took a picture of you, too bad. No NASA form. And believe it or not, the next one's real. If you fly drugs back and forth across the border, a NASA form will not prevent criminal enforcement against you. And every year, NASA turns over forms reporting these things to the DEA. It's just amazing. Don't do that. You can't benefit from the program if you've had a violation in the last 5 years. This does not mean that you can only file one form every 5 years. A lot of people get confused on that. You can file a form every day of your life. I've actually filed forms for things that didn't even involve me flying. I used to be a freight dog, and I flew at night, and I saw a lot of problems with the fact that the freight dogs didn't want to report icing conditions to each other because some of us were flying airplanes that weren't de-iced. And I wrote a long NASA form saying, you know, this ought to be addressed. To my knowledge, it's never been addressed. But that's a problem in the system. You know, this isn't just a get-out-of-jail-free card. One per crew member. You know, two pilot crew, each crew member needs to send in their own NASA form. Very important. That identification strip that comes back, the top that's got your name, your address, says type of occurrence. And this is just an easy way for the FAA and the NTSB to know that whatever you're writing about actually applies to the flight that you're in trouble for. There's a famous case that a pilot wrote on the NASA form, ran out of fuel. And then the FAA came after him for running out of fuel, and he contested it. But to cover his, you know, cover his bases, he went ahead and gave the FAA and the NTSB the strip saying, ran out of fuel. Now, by law, the NTSB and the FAA cannot consider any information from this program in coming against you. And so the judge said in his decision, finding that the guy ran out of fuel, that reading that on the identification strip had no bearing on his decision. So my favorite thing to write on a NASA form for type of occurrence on the identification strip is ATC misunderstanding, by the way. Covers a lot of areas. All right, the DOT. Most of you think of, you know, the FAA is the only agency that can investigate you. The DOT, starting about 10 years ago, has been paying more and more attention to business aviation. Their primary concerns are citizenship and marketing. Citizenship's more obvious. What's marketing about? Well, let's say that you work for a charter operator whose flights are marketed by a broker, or that flies for a broker. You, as the charter operator, can get in trouble with the DOT for something your broker did. If your broker marketed themselves as having a fleet of aircraft, and you enable them to keep up that little myth, you, the 135 operator, can receive a civil penalty from the DOT. Important to know. DOT is a much smaller investigative body than the FAA, and therefore they seem much more rational and easy to deal with because there's not all these conflicting opinions within their organization, is the way you sometimes find with the FAA. However, their legal issues are much more arcane. The DOT does not put out advisory circulars. The DOT makes no education effort the way the FAA does. And so, like this broker issue, in October of 2004, they did put a notice in the Federal Register. I'm sure you all caught it that day, explaining, you know, their position on these broker issues. Now, you can get this information from NBAA. You can find that notice on the NBAA website. But the DOT doesn't have any formal process to tell you before the violations what their enforcement concepts are. Typical procedure with the DOT, very similar to the FAA, in that there's typically a letter of investigation, a request for documents. You meet with them. And this means going to Washington, by the way. You sit down, and very often, much more often than with the FAA, there is a chance that they will drop the matter. They're still learning about us. I think another 10 years from now, I won't be saying that. Because in many instances, specifically on these marketing issues, if you go in and explain what you were doing in an acceptable way, the meeting may go for a couple of hours because they're still trying to learn who we are as a business, what we're doing. But they may just drop the matter with no fine, no violation of any kind. If what you've done is something more egregious, an example recently in a case involving marketing, illegal marketing of aviation, DOT assessed a $400,000 civil penalty. But it was somebody that they'd already violated before. I don't remember what the guy paid the first time, but it was not even six figures. And because he was a repeat offender, he got up to $400,000. And I suspect if his name ever shows up in any aviation business, they will immediately be under investigation. There is an administrative law process with the DOT, just like what Lori described. It's almost never used. The DOT has a consent order process where they write up their allegations. They will acknowledge that you may not agree with all of those allegations, and then they'll have a civil penalty. And the DOTs, you can work with on paying civil penalties. This gives them the ability to talk about a big number and you the ability to not pay the big number. Typical method is the civil penalty will be for $150,000. You pay $75,000 over 2 years, and if during those 2 years you make the payments on time and you don't do any bad things again, you are forgiven the second $75,000. Most government agencies don't do it that way. So the DOT kind of operates in their own little world in that respect. More fun issues. Insurance. You will soon figure out I don't work for insurance companies. I don't sell insurance. I'm just here to tell you some hard facts about insurance. An insurance policy is just a contract. If certain things occur as specified in the contract, then the insurance company has to pay. If there's a catastrophic accident involving $50 million, $100 million, $200 million policy, the insurance company would say that they owe it to their shareholders to investigate the possibility of not paying. I've almost got that phrase down, don't I? You need to be aware of what the issues are if that were to happen. First off, most of you know that for the insurance to be valid, the pilots flying the aircraft have to be approved. Okay? So if somebody flying the airplane is not meet the approved criteria of the coverage, there's no coverage. What many pilots don't realize is that being approved as a pilot doesn't mean that the insurance extends to you. To have the insurance cover you, protect you from a judgment, that means you have to be an additional insured as well as an approved pilot. Not that complicated a concept, but an important one. Another thing that insurance companies will look for is whether the airworthiness certificate was valid at the time of the accident. Every insurance company requires a valid airworthiness certificate. That doesn't just mean that the piece of paper was in the airplane. Legally, a valid airworthiness certificate means there's no open maintenance items that are not properly deferred. So, has an airplane fully returned to service? And or has that been documented? Are you on a ferry permit? Most policy would require a special rider. In other words, call the insurance company and get permission to move the airplane on a ferry permit prior to the flight. And there have been accidents involving ferry flights where there was no coverage for that exact reason. Insurance company is going to look at who's on board. The best situation for the insurance company is everybody on board is covered by workers' comp, because that vastly reduces the amount of money that the insurance company might have to pay. So the insurance company, if there are not non-employees on the plane, insurance company is going to look at why were they there and were they paying? Are you a Part 91 operation that's getting reimbursement? Most insurance policies today do not have a provision that says any violation of the federal aviation regulations can avoid coverage. Most states have said that's too broad. That's too broad of an exemption. And the states don't allow it anymore. But an insurance company can always get out of coverage if they can show that the insured, the company that got the policy, lied in obtaining the policy. And so if you say that we're a Part 91 operation, we don't charge anybody, and then they find you charging someone in a way that's not authorized under Part 91, that's a good way for the insurance company to try to get out of coverage. And the way they'll do it is just to say, you know, Judge, our premiums are much higher for a commercial operation because workers' comp protects us in Part 91. Here, these people were obviously not workers' comp. They were paying. And then the kicker that the insurance companies are really good at is, and here's the rule from Part 135 that if they'd followed it like they should have, would have prevented this accident. So, Judge, you've got to deny coverage to ensure safety. You've got to send the message. It's a beautiful thing from an evil lawyer point of view, but be aware of that. The OSU accident. There have been a number of athletic team accidents over the years that have sparked changes in the regulations. Wichita State in the 1970s caused the writing of the Truth in Leasing Rule, 91.23. More recent accident, OSU, we got involved on behalf of an airplane that did not crash. There were three airplanes transporting the team that day. One airplane crashed, killing everybody on board. The FAA commenced an investigation to find out if the other two airplanes were illegal charters. Now, they were Part 91 flights provided for free by the alumni. You'd think that would be the end of it. No. The FAA wanted to know, where do these alumni sit at the games? Where do they get to park? Do they get to go to special receptions? So the compensation issue, the FAA really delved into. So be aware that compensation may not just be money. Subrogation. Insurance companies always reserve the right to sue whoever caused the accident to get back what they paid you. Okay? So if you own an airplane and there's an accident, the insurance company has to pay you, they will turn around and try to sue to collect what they lost. What if you're the pilot? In light aircraft, it's very common for pilots to get sued by insurance companies to collect the loss. If a flight instructor is on a plane and the plane runs out of gas and crashes, the flight instructor will probably get sued to pay for the damage. Insurance company will pay if that instructor was approved to fly the plane, but even though he's approved, he still gets sued and he has to pay. In jets, you almost never see that. Jets, it's a whole different game because the dollars are so much larger. In jets, I hate to say it, but typically the pilot's not with us anymore. And because the dollars are so big, the focus tends to come to the manufacturers. Now, when I got introduced, it was pointed out I am a manufacturer. So if I'm biased, I'm biased. I'm also from Kansas, so give me a break. I tend to think that manufacturers get sued for a lot of cases that really weren't their fault. But I have seen over and over again in reading these cases that all of the different parties, all of the maintenance shops that have been sued, because everybody gets sued, everyone will kind of turn their attention to the manufacturer. You know, if there'd been a great big sign directly in front of the pilot's face saying, for God's sake, don't crash, maybe they wouldn't have crashed. And so the pilots are portrayed by everybody except the manufacturer as heroes struggling against the poor guidance from the manufacturer. The manufacturer is always the one stuck by themselves saying, come on, you did something stupid, which is tough because the widow's sitting there. So one more fun issue, criminal issues. The FAA has always had the legal ability to pursue criminal claims. They don't have much of a history of it, but they've always had the ability. There have been cases of pilots going to jail for lying on their medical application. They're rare, and I haven't seen one in over 10 years. But they do happen, and it on the form, lower left corner, I believe, of your medical application, it tells you that if you lie on the form, you can go to jail for up to 5 years and pay up to $250,000 fine. They can do that. The value jet crash is what changed this markedly for the rest of what we deal with. There were multi-million dollar penalties. They went after some of the actors for jail time. And it sparked a rash of criminal actions by the Department of Justice Office for the Florida region where this occurred. And that was back in the Clinton administration. Ever since Bush 2, we haven't seen any high-profile criminal actions taken against aviation criminals. Why? Because the NTSB, the entire time that the Department of Justice was doing this, was screaming at the DOJ to stop it. Because if aviation people start having constitutional rights to shut up, the NTSB might as well shut its doors. And this happened after the Challenger accident in Teterboro. Attorneys for some of the players involved said, and remember the airplane came from Florida, where the DOJ had a history of pursuing criminal claims. Attorneys were telling the players not to talk to the NTSB, not to talk to the FAA about fundamental things that caused the accident. So it's a real issue. It's a bad move by the DOJ to pursue criminal actions in our industry because it impacts safety so severely if the NTSB can't do its job. People always ask me, you know, if the FAA comes after me and I win, can I get my money back? Can I sue them for all of the damage they've done to my business? Well, it's a fundamental tenet of old English law that the king can do no wrong. Fundamentally, if you wanted to sue the king for whatever, you couldn't. The king can do no wrong. That followed into American law for almost 100 years until the passage of the Federal Tort Claims Act. Under the Federal Tort Claims Act, you can sue the government for negligence. Simple, run-of-the-mill negligence. The FAA gets sued for that all of the time successfully, for giving improper weather briefings, for steering airplanes into each other or into mountains. You can sue the FAA for that, and the FAA does, unfortunately, lose those cases from time to time. But you can't sue the FAA for performing its investigative functions, because the Federal Tort Claims Act has a number of defenses for the government that protect the government from doing purely government functions. An investigation is one of those. And so you can't sue them for defamation, libel, or slander, or interference with contracts. So if they come in, do a big, loud investigation that drives away all your business, and then you're found innocent, you have no claim under the Tort Claims Act. Now, I've reviewed cases against other agencies from time to time to look for parallels. And somebody sued a different agency under the creative concept that they negligently, unintentionally ruined me. They said stupid things without realizing that they were wrong and stupid. Nobody's tried that one yet on the FAA, because it's just a weird claim to say that they didn't know they were harming me, they didn't know what they were doing. most of the cases that have been thrown out were people bringing cases saying they intentionally ruined me. Now, you can sue the individual FAA employee for an intentional act if it's outside the scope of the investigation. Another thing that's hard to prove. You can go after the FAA after prevailing under the Equal Access to Justice Act, but it's strictly attorney's fees, and it's a separate action. So you go through all the appeal stage that Lori told you about, and you can get $137 an hour for your lawyer, which you probably didn't win if that's what you're paying your lawyer. But and there's a little game to it. You have to owe the lawyer. Now, lawyers talk about pro bono, which means for free. And lawyers joke about intentional pro bono, which is what we do for the good of the brotherhood. And then unintentional pro bono is we thought we were going to get paid and we didn't. To get paid under EJA, you have to owe the attorney the money. Our firm has been paid under EJA quite a bit. It typically takes a year to 2 years to actually get a check from the FAA under EJA. But it does happen, and it spins really well. Prevail doesn't just mean winning in court. If they come after you for something ridiculous, let's say they come after you for a full year suspension and you settle it for a 30-day suspension, you can collect under EJA for that. Typically, the settlement that got you to 30 days will say, and oh, by the way, you better not come after us for EJA. Substantial justification. You have to prove that not only did you win, but the FAA had no reason to come after you in the first place. This applies to both the facts and the law. If they have a perfectly good case, but they knowingly bring it way too late, typically beyond 6 months, you can collect under EJA for going to court and getting it thrown out. If the case is tight and it comes down to the judge's decision of looking somebody in the eye and determining if they're lying or not, win or lose, the FAA doesn't have to pay because they were substantially justified if it was close enough that the judge had to decide which side was telling the truth. The bottom line for dealing with any of these government agencies is to be calm, be polite, okay? Do what your parents taught you. Don't, if you can't say something that's nice or true, shut your mouth. Remain paranoid for at least 6 months because the FAA has a long time that they can be looking at you. And Lori explained hearsay, so don't be talking to the linemen and, you know, especially anybody who could become a disgruntled former, whatever. Because when we look at enforcement investigative reports and see who the witnesses against a pilot or mechanic are, they all fit into the category of disgruntled former, spouse, coworker, something. Be careful who you talk to because hearsay is evidence. Writing down facts for your attorney is kind of a joke. If you write things down with the intention of someday hiring an attorney and giving the notes to the attorney, that's close enough for attorney-client privilege, at least in my book, and you won't have to give those notes to anybody who tries to subpoena them. And because these things can take so long, it's important to keep contemporaneous notes for yourself and your attorney. Questions for either one of us? Stunned silence. Yes.
You talked about a broker. If you're a charter operator and you're doing a flight for a broker and you
yep.
incur some kind of penalty through the broker, does that only apply to the charter operator or all the pilots that may be employed by that charter operator?
At this point, I would say it would be the 135 company itself. The pilots, in theory, could get enforcement from the FAA for that. The FAA would have to show knowledge. A little tougher.
Thanks.
follow up on that question. What constitutes due diligence in a broker situation from your point of view?
And just so everybody understands, these are hypothetical questions that I've planted in the audience. And good job, because that came across very sincere. What constitutes due diligence? Well, I would say the best step is look at the broker's website. Because if the broker's website says things that are just obviously not true, like, we have a fleet of thousands, you don't want to be doing business with them. Or at least you don't want to do business with them until after they fix their website. That's probably the biggest step in due diligence. Other questions?
On your interest slide, you had ramp checks. Notice you didn't really mention anything about those. So, like, what do they look for, and what can you do to combat that?
Yeah, you know, it used to be the FAA had the driving money to do just general surveillance, and a ramp check was kind of a common thing. I'd like to think it's common, because I've had over half a dozen ramp checks, and I don't want to think that it's just because I give these talks. Be polite, be brief. Set a time limit at the beginning. You know, and Lori said this, they can't detain you for any reason. So, you know, me, I'm old, I always have to go to the bathroom. So if somebody comes up, starts asking me questions, I'm like, yeah, glad to help you. I need to go to the bathroom. So here's my documents. If you have any questions, give me a call. Bye. Nothing wrong with that. Be polite. Don't lie. Today, if you get a ramp check, I'm 99% sure they're there for you. Especially if there's two of them. If you're walking down the ramp and you see two guys in matching polyester blue blazers, go to the bathroom. So, you know, you got to do a real quick thought of what are they here for? Especially if they were there to meet the plane. You've got to show them your documents, airman, medical, registration on the plane. You're not required to have any maintenance records with you. I don't recommend anybody travel with the aircraft maintenance records. And then beyond that, set a time limit. Get out of there. Okay?
If that was a Part 135 operation, are you then also obligated to show them your discrepancy log and your flight log and manifest and all?
Yeah, if you're commercial, there's more things that they can ask to look at. They are not supposed to detain you and delay your flights. So, you know, again, try to keep limits around it. All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I really enjoyed that presentation. It was great. That's one.
I have my question. Hi, Nick Clark from Jim's Air. Remember? He came out to see us a long, long time ago.
A very long time ago.
Yeah, well, we're still in business. No, actually, we've grown. We're up to 5 aircraft now. Interestingly enough, we are in the midst of negotiating our first joint ownership.